Welcome to the archives of The Loralee Show, conversation for exploration, timeless discussions to challenge and expand our worldview. And while you may find our guests fascinating, the views expressed may not necessarily reflect those of our own or of the Cuyamangue Institute. That's why we call it Conversation for Exploration. And join in our ongoing live events, interviews, our own presentations, and much, much more as we go exploring. Learn more at CuyamangueInstitute.com and Loralee.com. And hello there, I'm Loralee, and thanks for tuning into Conversation for Exploration. This show is an adventure. This show is a forum in which researchers on all manner of interesting material, from ancient mysteries to new science and everything in between, oh, and let's not forget those anomalies out there, have a chance to present their views so we can try on their new theories, muse upon them, share thoughts with one another, converse, just like over the dinner table. You know, here we are, the dishes have been pushed away, the coffee served, and let's sit back and go on yet another adventure. And this is one that's dear to my heart, because as a woman, and I'm so glad I live in this society today where women have options and we have a life that we can live of our own and choices that we can make, and we can do just about anything men can do in these days. But it wasn't always so. It hasn't been so for about 5,000 years. Even today, I keep bumping up against chauvinism and against the patriarchy, and it's irritating. And I keep wondering and looking around, you know, I'm as smart as other men, I'm as capable as other men. How did men ever get the thought that women were less than them? I know, I'm not going to go on a feminist rant right now, but I can tell you that these and every woman alive today has had these thoughts. How did the patriarchy suddenly get the idea that they were the king of the hill? How did this happen? It used to be that the feminine in nature was honored with the goddesses, that women had as equal say in society as men. Used to be that way. How did it get any different? Well, Leonard Slain has a theory about that, and it's not just the typical old theories that you've heard over and over again. This one is so fascinating. This has to do with innovation, new technologies. Okay, in ancient times, new technologies that, you know, you can't bypass them. They're just so efficient, and they make so much sense, and you've got to use them. But he says, you know, beware of those technologies that change the way our brains function. And we have learned since then. We've had researchers on the show that talk about things you can do to remap your brain tissue. If you've lost some functioning of the brain through an accident, say, you can actually do simple motor functions that help relay down the neurological pathways in your brain. You can get your brain functioning again. And scientists now tell us that just because you passed adolescence doesn't mean that you're still not growing new brain tissue, and that your brain cells aren't still changing and adapting and activating. They tell us that children who learn music at an early age lay down more corpus callosum, that's the connective tissue between left and right hemispheres, than do children who don't learn music. Why? Because you require communication between both hemispheres of the brain in order to play and to read and to do music. So this covers so many different fields. I think it's a fascinating theory. And as Leonard presents it to you, take some notes, because I'm sure that you're going to have something to say about this. I'd love your reaction. I want to talk about the implications. We'll also ask him, well, today we use two hands, as he points out, and we have lots of different ways that our brain functions. We have so many different influences on it. What does our future hold if what he says is true about our past? And does this provide a window into our history to look at the forces that were unleashed as new technologies were introduced, new innovations were introduced? Is this not a clarion call for looking at how changeable our society is today and asking, where are we going from here? Let me introduce you to Leonard. He joins us from the San Francisco and Bay Area. He's actually a surgeon, and yet he's written two books, The Alphabet Versus the Goddess, in which he presents this theory about the goddess to the patriarchy and why, and another book, Art and Physics, Parallel Visions in Space, Time, and Light, in which he suggests that ideas are waiting to be born. I believe that too. And artists often grab them out of the ethers before even the scientist, but they both have their own ways of expressing the same scientific paradigms from art to science, the same, actually, new paradigms, new models of the universe. We're going to get into that as well. Hello, Leonard. Thanks for being here tonight. So what's a surgeon doing mucking about in all this interesting territory?
Well, that's a question that I'm frequently asked. To give you a little background, when I wrote Art and Physics, I treated those two subjects as if they were just simply languages. Art is the language of image and metaphor. Physics is the language of numbers and equations. And I proposed in that book that the artist had frequently anticipated many of the ideas in physics.
Quick example, just so we get a real good sense of what you're talking about.
Well, for example, Monet in the 1890s.
The Impressionists,
Began painting, doing something that no other Western artist had done before, and that is he began painting the same object over and over again in space, but he painted it at different times of year and different hours of the day. So he painted the same haystacks in the summer that he did in the winter, as if to say, I, as an artist, cannot show you the essence of haystacks unless you see not only where they're located in space, but you also have to see how they change in time. And Minkowski, a physicist, looking at Einstein's equations 20 years later, reached the conclusion that there was a next higher dimension that he, Minkowski, named the space-time continuum. And to explain that concept, he made a diagram called the space-time diagram, which combines the three vectors of space and the three durations of time, past, present, and future. Well, in my presentations, I show Monet's haystack side by side with Minkowski's space-time diagram, and there's really not a lot of difference between the two. They're both expressing the same idea, but they're using different languages.
Same idea, two different languages. Tell us about, for another example, Picasso. What was Picasso doing?
And cubism was the representation of multiple sides of an object seen simultaneously. Einstein, in 1905, came out with a special theory of relativity, and in it, he gave the example of being on a train that was accelerating towards the speed of light, and if you were looking out the window, all you would be able to see at first would be the front of the objects, but as you traveled at relativistic speeds, you would see the front of the object and the side of the object, and then as you closed in on the speed of light, you would see the front, the side, and the back of the object simultaneously. Now, I maintain that there's only two places in the universe that you would ever see the front, the side, and the back of something all at once.
Simultaneously.
And one would be in a cubist painting, and the other one would be on Einstein's train ride. It's almost as if Einstein had called Picasso and Braque and said, fellas, I'm having a really difficult time explaining to the public what it is I've discovered. Could you guys make a diagram of it? And they did. But I'm not at all implying that the artist or the physicist had any knowledge of what the other was doing. These were two parallel visions proceeding along independently of each other. And interestingly, throughout history, in many examples, the artist seems to anticipate what the physicist is going to express in numbers and equations.
And does it through that beautiful language of symbology.
Yeah.
And life is a continuum. It was because Leonard wrote this book and was doing this research that led him directly to the goddess to patriarchy transition. We'll talk about that coming up right here on The Laura Lee Show. I'm Laura Lee. Laura Lee here on The Laura Lee Show. Leonard Schlein is our guest. And Leonard, where did you go from seeing that artists were in their own language expressing the same things that scientists then latched onto and expressed in there through math and equations in one language, symbol and an art in the other?
Well, to write that book, I had to immerse myself in communications theories. I've always been a very big fan of Marshall McLuhan and his ideas about how the technology of a medium is, and the information transfer is in many respects more important than the content of the information. I'm a surgeon, and I've done a lot of vascular surgery, and I've operated on the carotid arteries to the brain, and I've always been fascinated by the very different functions performed by the different hemispheres of the human brain. So armed with this knowledge, I went on a Mediterranean tour of archaeological sites, and this fantastic guide that we had, everywhere we went and stood before the temples of Poseidon or Zeus or Apollo, she told us that, this temple was originally consecrated to a goddess, and then for unknown reasons, unknown persons later consecrated these temples to a god. And that happened everywhere we went in the Mediterranean, and on this long bus ride back to the airport, I was contemplating what I saw, and it's clear that there's overwhelming archaeological and historical evidence that both men and women both worshipped goddesses in the early historical societies. Women were priestesses and enjoyed a very high status in these societies, and property generally passed to the mother's line. And then beginning about 5,000 years ago, the goddess began losing power, and with the start of a Western culture, she basically disappeared. The three religions of the West, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, did not have a goddess. Women were banned from conducting any religious sacraments, and property began passing exclusively through the male line. And I found this to be such an extraordinary changeover that when I examined the various theories that are extant to explain this phenomenon, I found that all of them were unsatisfactory. And it occurred to me that this changeover from a feminine focus to a masculine one occurred about the same time that people were learning how to read and write. And we know that in a child's brain, that what you teach a child reinforces certain neuronal pathways, and what you don't teach a child causes other neuronal pathways to wither, so that if a child doesn't learn a certain information, like, say, a second language by a certain age, then it's very difficult for that person to learn the language as an adult.
Or the famous cat experiments where they brought up a cat in a room that had no horizontal lines.
Exactly.
The cat couldn't even recognize a horizontal line when shown one.
So reading and writing are such a linear and sequential function that I wondered whether or not the societies that learned how to read and write caused one hemisphere to be reinforced, the one that processes information linearly, which in right-handed people is the left hemisphere. And I think for ease of conversation tonight, I think I'll only refer to right-handed people and that are left brain dominant, because it'll make it easier. Right-handed people constitute 92% of the population, but in no way am I tend to belittle left-handers here.
I'm married to a lefty. He does quite fine. And I will say that Paul's feminine side and masculine side are quite well balanced. So
it's interesting, just as an aside, I mean, straight men who are right-handed have the most dichotomous brain, in that 90% of their language centers are located in their left hemisphere.
Huh.
But women and homosexual men and left-handed people do not have that degree of dichotomy. They may have 80-20 rather than
90-10.
So there is a difference in the brains of men and women and these other subsets that I talked about. But getting back to the thesis, I proposed that when a culture learned how to read and write, particularly an alphabet, because alphabets were a revolutionary new way to communicate because they were so simple.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a four-year-old can learn how to use an alphabet. Forrest Gump can learn how to use an
alphabet. What is the definition of an alphabet? How does that
alphabet
differ from, say, a series
of
hieroglyphs? Go ahead.
A form of writing that has less than 30 symbols that stand for phonetic values of letters, as opposed to syllabaries or pictographic forms of languages such as hieroglyphics or Chinese ideographic writing.
Now, in a Chinese alphabet system, there are, what, thousands upon thousands of pictograms that you have to learn, so it's a much more difficult language system to learn.
Pictograms in their language. Most Chinese get along with knowing only 2,000 or 3,000, but it's based on an entirely different principle than the alphabet. A Chinese ideograph contains an image of a concept, as opposed to an alphabet, which is the linear arrangement of meaningless symbols in a row, in a certain sequence to create meaning. In fact, in the Chinese language, there is no word for the word word, because there are no words in Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
But in English, we, or any of the alphabet languages, we line up these letters in a certain sequence in a very linear fashion. And I maintain that the processing of information in such a manner causes societies that learn this form of communication, both the men and the women in it, to shift into a masculine mode. And this manifests itself in society as an abhorrence of images, a denigration of women's rights, and the disappearance of goddesses.
And those three hallmarks show that shift.
Yeah. The reason that images are included in this is that in the brain, we have two complementary modes of perception, a very linear sequential one, which is on the left hemisphere, and a very holistic, synthetic, and concrete one in the right hemisphere. The right hemisphere recognizes images and sees information all at once, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Sees the parts to the whole, can recognize patterns, It can look at a maze and figure out how to get out of it.
That's the right brain function.
Yeah. Yeah. It can read a map. And the most complex image that anybody has to perceive is the human face. So we're able to look at somebody we haven't seen in 30 years and spot them in a crowd, and even though they're wrinkled and have gained weight and are balding, we know that that's our college roommate. It's an astonishing skill.
They've also found out how early babies start to recognize faces through some recent experiments. Yeah. And so this is a skill that they say is hardwired into our brains.
Yeah. Well, not only that, but a mother can look at her baby even before the baby can speak and read the baby's face and know that the baby needs to be changed. But most importantly, you can look somebody in the eye and know that that person is lying to you. And when you ask how you know, you can't describe it in words. It's an intuitive, uh-huh, holistic feeling. You just kind of know it. So there's two different kinds of information, and there's no value judgment I'm making on one over the other. We need both modes of perception to get along in the world.
And that's the judgment, is we need both. It's not that one it should replace or be exclusive to the other.
Right, but cultures that adopted alphabets, which were so easy to use that it held out the prospect of universal literacy for these societies. And and what happened in those cultures is that they adopted an alphabetic sacred text, and the alphabetic sacred text banned images, promoted monotheism, where only a god was ruling the world, not a goddess. And women basically lost their rights to own property, which, of course, is the key to power in any society. So the first book ever written in an alphabet is the Old Testament.
Uh-huh.
And in the Old Testament, the most important part of the Ten Commandments. And the first commandment is the most revolutionary sentence ever written. The first commandment states, I am the Lord thy God, there is no other. And prior to the transcription of this sentence, there had been no people in the world anywhere that had ever believed that the world could be created by a man alone. It was always a woman alone, two women together, more commonly a man and a woman, but never a man alone. And some of your listeners might take me to task and say, well, the Bible doesn't actually state that the deity is masculine, but in truth, all of the adjectives and pronouns and nouns that are used to describe him are all masculine, so we have to assume that he's masculine. Now, if you were to lay the Ten Commandments out on the table in front of you and ask your listeners to please put them in the sequence of their relative importance for their life today, I would venture to say that most people would put for number two, don't murder. But actually, number two is make no images. And it's not just graven images. It's nothing that flies in the air, or creepeth on the ground, or is under the sea.
Uh-huh.
So in the very first book, very first people that adopted an alphabetic sacred text, the banning of art becomes the first time in history that a culture ever made it a law that you couldn't create any art. So my question is, why would art be more dangerous than murder?
Uh-huh, because art, as you just pointed out, images, the recognition of images engages our right to hand side of the brain.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that in the three monotheistic religions of the West, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, the deity doesn't have an image. Yahweh doesn't have an image, and Allah certainly doesn't have an image. And the New Testament, which is this very detailed book about the comings and goings and sayings and doings of the prophet Jesus, that the gospel writers managed to leave out of this very detailed text a single sentence of description of what Jesus looked like.
So we can't even paint an image in our mind.
Yeah, so as a result, we don't know that he was tall or short or dark or blue-eyed. We don't know, because there's no physical description of Jesus. But Mary, on the other hand, appears as an image. I mean, as we speak, there are people gathering in some farmyard out in Georgia looking at a barn door because they see the image of Mary. And the interesting thing about the image of Mary is they see her in an image, but she doesn't say anything. I mean,
because
no
the image says so much, doesn't
There's
it?
No gospel according to Mary. So you see the goddess, you see the woman, the female deity in the image, but you have to know the male deity through his written words.
Oh, interesting. Interesting how Mary seems to be a stand-in for that goddess as well, slipped in there between the lines. We continue with Leonard Slane as he presents his very interesting theory. We'll give you plenty of time to react to it. You're listening to The Laura Lee Show. I'm Laura Lee. I'm Laura Lee. This is The Laura Lee Show. Our guest is Leonard Schlein, author of Art and Physics and The Alphabet Versus the Goddess. And Leonard, in hearing you lay out your theory, I just have two comments. It's interesting that our alphabet did derive from pictograms, you know, the classic A, letter A, turn it upside down, and it's the bull's head with the horns. So it's interesting how it got more and more and more abstract from that. You can see that progression there so nicely. And also, it's interesting to contemplate how our brains are wired by the simple things that we do, and how through a certain wiring of our brains, or lack of wiring, if certain connections aren't made, it's interesting how this changes our perception, our conventions, our relationships, our society. I mean, if what you're saying is true, I mean, this is just absolutely stunning how insidious and widespread and subtle an effect this is, but how profound the effects.
You know, Sophocles once warned that nothing vast enters the life of mortals without a curse.
Or a cost.
I think your listeners would agree that if they won the lottery ticket tomorrow, there would probably be something in there that wouldn't be wonderful. So clearly, the invention of literacy was vast. I mean, any culture or person that gains access to literacy undergoes a transformation. The cultures develop new philosophical systems, religious reforms, legal codes, new styles of art, architecture, music. It's a tremendous boon. But at the same time, there's something about it that has caused women's rights to be diminished in the early stages of literacy. Madness has taken over societies, and people smash images.
Now, you say madness. How do you define that? What's an example?
Well, I mean, literacy leads to individuality, because in an oral society, everyone is bound to that society, and it's ruled by taboos, and if you break a taboo, it isn't that you bring misfortune on yourself, you bring misfortune on everybody. Whereas if you break a law, you're just breaking the law, and it's only you that broke the law.
Oh, and laws have to be written, okay.
Yeah, and laws are written, and therefore, and you see, when in conversation, in an oral society, there is nothing independent of speech. The speech depends on the speaker. But once you have a written document that you can put on the table over there, and you can talk about that independent document as an independent object, then it allows abstract thought far in excess to what a person can think about if they're part of an oral society. So a great deal of ego development and individuality come into being as a result of becoming literate, and of course the price that we pay for that is that we're torn out of the matrix of the culture within which we reside, as well as nature. And instead of viewing us as part of nature, we start to view nature as something else to be conquered, to be used as a resource, and we lose that connection, which nowadays we're trying so hard to reconnect to. But there, you know, it's like Joni Mitchell singing in that song about something gained and something lost and living every day. Uh-huh. So there's no doubt that early missionaries, that when they first met the people in the new world, they were astonished at the different forms of structuring their world that non-literate people did than literate people. So, for instance, a Hopi Indian or an Iroquois or a Polynesian has totally different concepts of space and time and reality than a person from a Western culture who's been taught literacy. And we've had several periods in our history where...
That's right, isn't it?
Yeah, for example, during the Dark Ages, after the fall of Rome, there was this astonishing period called the Dark Ages, when virtually no one in Northern Europe could read or write except a few monks in monasteries. So you would think that during this period when superstition and barbarity ruled, that women would have been suffocated and women's rights would have suffered. But when the stage of history gets reilluminated in about the 10th century, we find all over Europe that there are troubadours and jongleurs singing the praises of women. There's a new military code called the Chivalry Code, which states that the highest aspiration of a man is to protect the women of the realm. There's women Christian mystics that are revered by the church. Abbesses rule the monasteries. And most importantly, the people of Europe have begun to venerate Mary and start to expend enormous quantities of time, energy, and money to raise these fantastic cathedrals dedicated to Notre Dame.
Oh, yes, all the Our Lady cathedrals.
Yeah.
Not only that, but they put them in the constellation, the Virgo. So if you look at all the small Our Lady or Notre Dame cathedrals in France and you connect the dots in a certain way, it looks very much like the constellation of Virgo, heaven on earth.
Right. Well, not only that, but if you travel...
And Virgo the Virgin, right? We're back to Mary. Go ahead.
Right. If you travel in an arc from Poland through Russia, Germany, Switzerland, France, Italy, Spain, you can find a church that has its most sacred object, a statue of a black Madonna. And why would a Caucasian people who were substantially blue-eyed and blonde-haired be venerating a statue of a black Madonna? And I think the answer to that is that black is the color of night. It's the color of soil. All of the early earth mothers, such as Isis and Artemis and Kali and Cybele, were all manifested as black goddesses. So the phenomenon of the Black Madonna occurred primarily during that period in European history when people could not read and write.
Yeah.
And as soon as the Middle Ages began and they started to become literate again, the phenomenon disappeared. And with the start of the Renaissance, with the invention of the printing press, literacy rates just skyrocketed.
Well, here's another example of that in terms of the black and white, left and right. It used to be in the goddess religion and still in the Chinese religion or Chinese mind think that all spectrums are good. They're all part of the world. It's this universal dance between good and bad, black and white, hot and cold, the yin, the yang. And that was just the way it was. And it seems to me we have a religion now that venerates the light, the white, and tries to deny the opposite end. And so even that's kind of an imbalance, according to some people, and certainly according to the indigenous cultures.
Well, I maintain that the reason that women have made such astonishing gains in the last 50 years is primarily because in the 19th century, the invention of photography and the discovery of electromagnetism brought images and image technologies to begin to challenge the printing press, which was very linear and sequential and brought a lot of print technology.
Yeah.
So the suffragette movement occurred not long after the invention of photography, and then in the 20th century with film and television, graphic advertising, computers, all of which are combinations of electromagnetism and photography, an astonishing rise in the value of images. We get most of our information from images today. In fact, I would maintain that since the Western culture has been primarily about long imageless tomes written by esteemed white males, that it's moved to cultures such as Plato or Aquinas or Augustine. There has not been a single book in the last 50 years that even begins to compare to the power of images. The image of the atomic bomb in 1948, the image of the Earth beamed back from space in 1968, the little girl running down the road in Vietnam, Waco, Somalia. We have an archive now of visual images in our brain.
Earth from space.
Yeah, that have changed us more than any book that has been written in the last 50 years.
You know, that's a really good point. And look at the delivery systems. Television came along just the right time to help convey those images so we can all see them. We used to have a common mythology. Now we have a common image bank, as you point out. The internet. You've got that screen right there. Radio is verbal delivery of conversation. That takes both sides of the brains, I'm sure. You're not just looking at text like you would in a book. And look at the number of people that aren't reading anymore but are turning to other systems for enjoying knowledge like radio and the internet.
Well, I know that a lot of people are very down on television. They think it's just a terrible...
that it cuts off the creative...
The truth of the matter is that if you were to connect somebody up to EEG leads and give them a book to read, it doesn't matter what the content of the book is. It can be about sex and violence, or it can be nature stories or mystery stories. It doesn't matter. They generate something called beta waves. Beta waves are what you generate when you're concentrating on a task. And we know that to read a book, you need bright light. The book can't be moving. You need quiet. You got to concentrate. Now, if that person looks up from their book and starts watching a television program, it doesn't matter what the program is. It can be fake wrestling matches, cuddly koala bears, sex and violence. It doesn't matter. What happens is the beta waves go away and alpha and theta waves come up. And alpha and theta, which you generate when you meditate. And I think that everybody can relate to the experience of coming home at the end of a hard day's work and sitting down in the couch and taking the clicker in your hand and going into a trance. If you ask people, that's used in the responses is hypnotizing.
Uh-huh.
So if you measure their brain flow using a PET scanner, and you give somebody a book to read, again, the content of the book is irrelevant. The left hemisphere is pretty well lit up, and the right hemisphere is relatively dark. If you ask the person to look up from their book and start watching a television set, then almost immediately the left hemisphere begins to get dark, and the right hemisphere lights up.
So that perfectly illustrates what McLuhan was saying, with the medium is the message.
Now, you can't have a culture that has their television sets on 5 hours a day on average and not have the culture be profoundly affected
because
by the
image medium
that they're getting.
And the medium is also influencing the way that our brains work.
I mean, you know,
so we're back to, no, you're making a very profound point. Let's showcase this point, because it really is solving the problem and putting us back to balance, it seems to me, or at least it has the potential. Because as you point out, Leonard, everybody's on their keyboards nowadays. I never write with pen and paper except taking notes during this show or take a few notes here and there, but we're on our keyboards all day. What are we doing? We're typing with two hands. What is that doing? That's balancing our brain, correct? And we've got screens in front of us. We're seeing images all over the place. We've got images that are causing our right brain to kick in, because we need that to do image recognition. And so what are we doing but getting back into a whole brain functioning, is your point. Therefore, the solution is right in front of us, getting back to balance.
Well, we don't even have to do anything. That the technology is going to do it for us. You know, when you're in conversation with somebody,
and
what's happening in a conversation is two things. When you're listening to somebody, your left hemisphere is following what the person is saying in a very linear, sequential fashion.
Okay.
If you don't follow what they're saying, you can't understand them. But at the same time, your right hemisphere is watching them. You're seeing whether they've got dandruff on their shoulders, whether the shoelaces are tied, you know, whether they're drumming their fingertips on the tabletop, you know, whether they have alcohol on their breath. How do they present themselves? There's an enormous amount of nonverbal communication going on in any conversation. And furthermore, when you're speaking to somebody, even though your left hemisphere is your language lobe and it's generating the speech, you still require both sides of your lips, both sides of your vocal cords, both sides of your tongue to speak properly. In fact, if you've been to the dentist and you've had Novocaine on one side, you come back and you're having trouble speaking.
Yeah.
So as a result, even though speech is generated primarily from one hemisphere, in order to talk or listen, we need to have both hemispheres involved. But when you write or read, you're basically using just one side. When you write, you only use one hand. You can take your left hand and put it in your pocket while you're writing, because you don't really need it. So the right hand of both men and women who are right-handed is the aggressor side of their nature. It's the same hand that throws the spear, swings the sword, pulls the trigger, and putting into the right hand and cutting the left hand out of the process of creating the written word is a act that infuses what's written with a certain strife and argumentativeness and masculine edge to it that speech doesn't have.
Now, that explains then why in French, left, sinister, has that association, and why we call the right side the right hand,
no,
and you have
bill
that
of
association.
Left, only a bill of rights. You know?
Exactly that. So it's there in our very language, isn't it, in some sort of subconscious way?
I mean, it's no accident that the printing press was invented in 1454.
Yeah.
And immediately what happened was that literacy rates soared all over Europe, and people rushed to learn how to read and write, because they all wanted to read a book that no one had a chance to read, but everybody had talked about, and that was the New Testament. And reading the New Testament for the first time, which is a book about love and kindness and forgiving, should have made the people loving and kind and forgiving. But that's not what happened. What happened was the Protestant Reformation, which was an all-male movement, and the Protestants said, now that we can read this book by ourselves, we want to reform Christianity, and high on our list of reforms is we're going to get rid of Mary and we're going to destroy all the images. So you see that same pattern over and over again. And then what happened next is very difficult to explain, because we humans have a fairly bestial streak in us that causes us to periodically attack our tribes across the river and so on and so forth. But the one thing that we haven't done in great numbers is we haven't killed our neighbors. And all over Europe for 150 years, Europe was consumed by the most vicious, sadistic religious persecutions in each country. So that in England, Anglicans were killing Puritans. Puritans and Puritans and Presbyterians were killing Anglicans, and in France, Huguenots and Catholics were killing each other, and in Germany, the Lutherans and the Calvinists were killing each other, and in Spain, the Catholics had been living side by side with the Jews and the Moors for centuries, and all of a sudden, right after the printing press, they decided they couldn't tolerate it anymore, so they began killing them and expelling them, and all over Europe you had this. So for 150 years, even though the society was experiencing this tremendous surge in scientific discoveries, music, art, architecture, and global exploration, at the same time, they were consumed with this murderous doctrinal disputes over religion. But as if that wasn't crazy enough, the culture that was giving us Shakespeare and Galileo and Newton and Bach
went mad.
The men in those societies decided that the women were so dangerous, that they had this psychotic delusion that the women were so dangerous they needed to be murdered. So the witch hunts of the 15th and 16th century occurred only in those countries that were impacted by the printing press. The witch hunts were the worst in Germany, Switzerland, France, England, Spain, and Italy. Russia, which was illiterate during this period of time, did not have any witch hunts.
That's a good point.
You know, Bosnia and Hungary, which were Muslim during this period, and the Muslims didn't adopt the printing press of the 19th century, they didn't have any witch hunts. And if you were to go to a Hopi Indian or an Iroquois or a Polynesian or a Kung Bushman, and you were to ask them, say, would you believe that there's a culture in the world where the men are murdering their wives, women, they would look at you in disbelief. They would say, that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard of. Nobody would be so dumb as to kill their women.
It's madness. Now,
yeah.
I think no one has ever been able
to explain why this outbreak of madness occurred only in the most sophisticated, advanced societies in the world at that time. And the only segment of the society that was persecuting women happened to be the noblemen, the church, the doctors, the lawyers, and it wasn't the peasants. The peasants were trying to protect their women.
And those were the ones that had the books and who were reading and had learned to read and were literate, you're saying. Let's react to Leonard Schlain's thesis. I think it's a fascinating one. I'm Laura Lee. Welcome to The Laura Lee Show. I'm Laura Lee. Right now, we're in the midst of a conversation with Leonard Schlain, who wrote two books, Art and Physics, subtitled Parallel Visions in Space, Time, and Light, in which he suggests that artists and scientists get the same ideas. They're just fomenting about in the universe, pull them down from the ethers and express them in two different ways. Artists generally first through symbolism, and then scientists through equations and physics. But same ideas, and he draws some fascinating parallels between the two. That took him then to look at the study of the brain, and he began to, through a trip to Greece, notice that the goddess was supplanted by a patriarchy. He began to think, why? And he noted, as he's been explaining over the last hour, that the rise in literacy might have had something to do with changing the way our brain functions so that it favors the left brain, the right-hand when you use with writing, with a single hand. He said spear throwing, all of that. That's the more aggressive masculine side, and the left side of the brain that this correlates to. And he says when you favor that and exercise that more than the other, which you do when you read text through the absence of images and all of that, he says it actually changed our brain functioning as a culture. The more that literacy spread with the advent of the alphabet as opposed to pictographs, which require whole brain thinking, with the advent of the printing press, which made books affordable and widespread and such, we became, he says, a more patriarchal society. Women were denigrated, and there was an art was absent, images were absent for Boughton for many periods, and we went from worshipping gods and goddesses to gods exclusively, so even our image of the divine changed. And he said that with the explosion of image here, when we had photography, images were now part of our cultural vernacular, with television, with the internet, which can show photographs. And don't worry, radio is not a culprit here, because to listen to conversation, that takes whole brain thinking as well. And he says, the solution, now we're typing with two hands as we use keyboards, the solution is right in the new technology that we're using. And guess what? We have gone far back to center as women are taking their rightful place side by side with men in the society. And you see a rise in interest in the goddess culture in general. You see, you see this all around, a lot more balance, it seems to me. And this has to do with our brains functioning. And think of the new generation, kids that grow up. Now they've got software for 18-month-olds. You know, learn to read and write right there on your computer. Look, think how their brains are going to be wired as opposed to how ours were wired. You said that literacy, Leonard, was the culprit. We want to get some reaction to that. I have to personally say that I learned to read when I was 5. My mother taught me, so I was keep asking her to read me books. She told me I took to it like a duck to water. I've spent a lot of time reading. I was a true bookworm. I love to read, and I'm just wondering how this changed me. I'm one of those big fans of literacy. I love the ability to go off and exploring in books. I'm a voracious reader, like so many of us. I'm sure you are as well. And yet, I think I'm not
advocating anybody stop reading. I think that reading is a fabulous skill. But what I wanted to point out in this book is that something that no one was paying attention to is that all great boons usually come with a price. And the price that we paid to become a very literate culture is the loss of women's rights and the denigration of images. And that I think that we need a more balanced approach to information perception, which is automatically happening because our technology is bringing it about. You were talking earlier about the computer. You know, when you write with a pen or a pencil, you have to watch what you're writing. You have to stay between the lines, so to speak. The manufacturers can easily make lined paper for us. If you were to look away when you were writing, your writing would go all over the page. But when you operate a computer, you're looking at the screen, and your right hand is operating a mouse. And the mouse, if you were to look at the mouse and not at the screen for a moment, the mouse is executing these very bizarre movements through on a mouse pad that are very geometrically and visual spatially required to do. And the right hand, left brain doesn't know how to do that. Those are visual spatial tasks that your right brain knows how to do. So here's your right hand performing this function, and it's a function that your right hand doesn't know how to do or your left brain does. So what has to happen in operating a computer is your left brain has to tiptoe across the corpus callosum mm-hmm. and invite the right brain to come on over to the other side to operate this mouse. So although the computer is used to manipulate information, the processes used to use a computer are very feminine. I mean, what effect does it have for an 8-year-old boy to log on to the World Wide Web mm-hmm. or the Internet? Because the last time I looked, all the major deities in ancient mythology who were associated with webs and nets were goddesses.
The spider and all of that.
Exactly.
Oh, God, it's so there when you point it out, isn't it? So, did you have anything left to say about the last caller before we go on to the next?
No, I thought that his point about, that alphabet, there's always been a mystic tradition in every alphabetic culture mm-hmm. that posits that the alphabet contains a cryptic message, whether it's the Kabbalists or the Sufis or the, that there's a message hidden in the alphabet. And I don't mean to denigrate that at all, but to say that throughout the West in its history, that has always been the minor motif, because the major one is that the truth is literal and the truth is contained between the covers of a book that was written by God, whether it was the Old Testament, the New Testament, or the Quran.
Mm-hmm.
So, in fact, what's going on in Washington today is very interesting because it's the strict literalists who believe that the Constitution should be taken literally are the ones who are also usually the
calling for
believers that the Bible contains information that is literally true. So there's always been this conflict between the literal interpretation versus the mythic interpretation.
Well, look how we take books and words and alphabets and give them kind of magical status. We take words and books and give them magical status, the holy books, as relics, so we do that a lot. Even in magicians, have their books and their words and their symbols and all of that. You're listening to The Laura Lee Show. I'm Laura Lee. I'm Laura Lee. This is The Laura Lee Show. We continue with Leonard Schlain. By the way, his books include Art and Physics and The Alphabet Versus the Goddess. Let's go back to the telephones and talk next to Paul in Fresno, California. Hi, Paul.
Good evening, Laura. Good evening, Leonard. I read your book, and it came out about the same time how they appeared in the newspaper in a crossword puzzle, and the British government's investigation actually concluded that there is an ether existence. But what I would disagree with you about is what you're talking about tonight about literacy and patriarchal behavior towards women. And the reason for that is this, that prior to the printing press coming to Europe, of course, Chinese had printing before that. In Europe, especially in England, there was persecution, massacres, witch burnings, culminating 300 years before the Gutenberg Bible ever existed.
Yes, but the most, the highest number of witches that were burned in England happened to occur during Elizabeth's reign.
Yes,
the Puritans were in control.
Right.
After
that,
the printing press.
But that's nothing to do with that. What that is manipulation of information, just like happened during in Germany. People manipulated information. It's nothing to do with literacy. In fact, the countries with the highest literacy rates in the world, Sweden, Finland, Denmark, Norway, Netherlands, and Belgium, are the most open, progressive, pro-feminine, pro-children's rights, pro-human rights, the highest incomes in the world. You look at the fratricidal, internecine problems in Africa right now, it's due to illiteracy. Where there is violence against people right now in our modern world, it's the manipulation of information.
Yeah. Well, your point is well taken, and that is a argument that is usually put forward as what's going on, that it's the content of the information and the access to literacy that determines things. But in my book, The Alphabet Versus the Goddess, I propose a different thesis, and I propose one that's fairly radical. And unfortunately, in the hour and a half that we have on this program, it's not possible for me to lay out all of the supporting arguments. But I propose that the process of becoming literate, that the actual hand-eye and brain coordination necessary to read and write requires a different form of mentation that reinforces the masculine side of both men and women, which then results in that society that learns it to become more masculine. Now, I noticed when you skipped by and you were relating all these historical things, you didn't stop on the witch hunts in the that occurred mostly in Europe, that were mostly after the printing press and their greatest virulence. The greatest outbreak of witch hunts and the madness that ensued with that occurred within a generation after literacy rates soared. And actually, the period of time that you were talking about, which was in England before the printing press, was actually a fairly egalitarian time. Women were abbesses in monasteries. They owned property. They enjoyed a much greater freedom and much greater status than they did afterwards.
Question, you did bring up a good point, Paul, is that in other countries where there isn't a lot of literacy, you do have a very strong patriarchy, although you do have matrilinear lines as well. So, you know, how do you answer that, Leonard?
Well, I mean, let's look at the Taliban. The Taliban were essentially illiterate until very recently. They began to have this incredible interest in this Quran, and they started to take away women's rights and ban images. And this is a pattern that you see throughout the world. When you talk about the African tribes that are engaging in this genocidal warfare, you have to realize that many of the pre-literate tribes in the world were very egalitarian. Women had the highest status in Iroquois tribes, Hopi Indians, Polynesians. And certainly I don't know that there are any peoples in the world that were matriarchal societies where women actually had more power than the men. But what happens is that once a culture comes in contact with Western culture, and that's happened in, since Columbus came to the United States, it's been 500 years, there's virtually no society in the world that has not had some member of that tribe or people become literate. And in the, there's an old saying that in the valley of the blind, the one-eyed man is king. All it takes is a couple of people within a society to become literate and realize the power that is inherent in that. And then that completely unbalances the society. So it's very difficult to draw conclusions about societies today that have been exposed to Western culture for 500 years and be able to say, well, see, that this culture is doing this because they're illiterate. That's not the point. The point is that let's go study some cultures that there was no literacy in and examine to see how women were treated. And admittedly, the evidence is very scant. We have to go into the archaeological record, and we find that the pre-literate peoples that we study, we find that we don't find warrior tombs with men buried with lots of weapons and retinue. We find the women buried in the more desirable locations. People built their villages in the bottoms of river valleys without fortifications. If you build your community in a river valley without fortifications, then you can count on the fact that these people were not concerned about being invaded by anybody. There are no scenes of war in any of the Neolithic cultures. You don't find deities hurling thunderbolts. Actually, you find the depictions of scenes of fertility and women giving birth and a much more feminine kind of culture. And then you begin to get this very warlike culture that comes in with history. And history means that you can write it down. And then when you start examining other world cultures that it came that were affected afterwards, there is virtually no culture in the world that hasn't had some anthropologist or missionary go in the last 500 years and introduce into that culture Western ways of communicating, which I maintain completely changed the culture.
Let's go back to the telephones, and we'll talk next to Rita. She's in Minneapolis on KSTP. Hi, Rita. You're on with Leonard Schlein.
Hi. It's really great to be talking to you, Laura and Leonard. I listen to your show almost every week, and you're one of my role models, Laura. And
oh, wow.
I just wanted to say I'm kind of in a bad mood, so I have a slight criticism when you said you didn't want to be getting into a feminist rant. I think there should be more feminist rants. And
I was afraid I'd scare everybody off.
Well, I know. I know that's true. But,
and we weren't going to get into a feminist rant. We were going to come and listen to Leonard Schlein. He's a guy.
Well, and I wanted to say I'm going to buy your book, and it sounds really, really interesting.
It is.
And what I don't quite get, though, is I could see the connection with what you're saying and what happened, but why did it have to be so vehemently anti-female? Couldn't it have just
been masculine? Good question. I mean, you know, the virulence of the hatred,
yeah,
and the tortures and the burnings that went on for so long, it takes one's breath away when you read about it. I have to tell you that when I wrote the chapters on the religious wars and the witch hunts, I remained depressed and disturbed for days, because when you actually, I don't think very many people really understand what happened. I've come in contact with a lot of men that think that the witch hunts consisted of the hangings of six women in Salem, Massachusetts, and that was the extent of it, you know. But actually, it was a rather widespread. And I don't know what other word to use for it other than psychosis. I mean, to have these delusions that women were capable of making men impotent and bringing on storms and so on and so forth, that actually the fairly bright segment of the society, scientists that were writing and making major contributions, such as Francis Bacon and William Harvey, who invented the circulatory system, were very much in support of the witch hunts. And, you know, when you go back and you read what they wrote about it at that time and what they said, it is almost unfathomable.
And, I know, yeah.
And you have to look for another cause in the culture, because if you examine the human history and you look at the entire world and all the world cultures, this is a phenomenon that occurred one time in one place and in one area. And there was nothing like what happened in Europe ever happened. Other cultures may have done some misogynist thing to their women, but no culture ever set out to systematically murder them. And that's a very bizarre thing. And it was happening at the same time that they were making these extraordinary advances in the arts and in music and global exploration and scientific discovery. So you have to wonder what was going on.
Isn't it unbridled?
There's never been a good explanation.
Well, kind of. It's just like, for example, when it was more matriarchal, what was the masculine factor doing at the time?
I think that the reason that came about is that beginning 10,000 years ago, you know, we lived as hunter-gatherers for approximately 2,990,000 years. And in a hunter-gatherer society, both the men and the women are economically interdependent on them, mm-hmm. on each other. The men depend on the women to supply them subsistence food in case the hunt is unsuccessful.
Heck, women invented gardening and agriculture.
Yes, but once you get into agriculture calls to the fore all of the feminine aspects of both men and women. The verb for tending children is the same verb we use for tending crops, because if you have a garden, you have to get out there in the morning, you've got to weed it, fertilize it, you know, water it, make sure that the crows don't get it. That's the same thing that people do and raise children. And when men and women began to domesticate animals and have herds and flocks, well, if you have a flock of chickens, you have to get up very early in the morning and go out there and feed them and water them and shelter them and make sure the coyotes don't get them.
So to stay in one place, we paid another price.
It's the same thing that mothers have been doing with children, and that is why in the early stages of agriculture, all of these societies began to worship one dominant deity known as the Earth Mother. She had a different name in different cultures, but there wasn't a single pre-literate and early historical society that did not venerate her above all other gods and goddesses. And even though the people remained agricultural at that time, 5,000 years later, the goddess starts losing power. This little puny male consort of hers, who was usually this weak son, lover, husband, brother, who died in an accident, suddenly starts, like he's taking steroids, becomes much stronger than she is. And then suddenly, with the start of a Western culture, only in the West, the goddess disappears. And only in the West do we have three religions emerge that are all based on an alphabetic sacred text: the Old Testament, the New Testament, and the Quran. All of them feature only a male god, no images, women can't perform any religious ceremonies, there are no goddesses, and women lose the right to own property. It's a correlation that's staggering when you start lining it up and looking at it carefully.
Well, thank you very, very much. Thank you too, Laura.
Oh, thank you for calling. Thanks for your kind words. And we continue with Leonard Schlain when we come back. I have some further comments. I'll save them for after this break. I'm Laura Lee. Laura Lee here on The Laura Lee Show. Just have to insert a couple of comments here. 3 points. Number one, really am not a feminist with women replacing men and this angry thing. I really feel like the whole point is balance, bringing it all up into play. I love that dance between all of those opposites. I think it's a fascinating story, and I believe in developing all aspects of yourself. You know, running like you're driving a 5-speed car. You want to go to each speed, each shift down to each thing as appropriate. Get your whole brain functioning. We're blessed with it. Let's use it in of all of its glory. Second point is interesting how the Egyptians used hieroglyphs. They used pictograms in a sense. And you can see on their temple walls storyboards. You know, they wrote in sequence. Pictures do a lot of the storytelling. They have hieroglyphs, but it seems like the hieroglyphs are in support of the pictures that they put on the walls in order to represent what they're talking about. More images. So they had an image. They had a culture in which images were just as important as the text. That's interesting to me. Also, Leonard, could you, before we go on, correct what you said, Paul, the earlier caller, was mistaken in saying what percentage of the population during the Middle Ages and during the printing press days and all of this were literate?
Well, we know...
Or even the Egyptians. I know the scribes and a few other people could read and write. How widespread was that in the population?
Well, in the early... Their first forms of language were cuneiform and hieroglyphics. And in those societies, it's estimated that less than 2% of the population could read and write. Alphabet literacy was... made it possible for a culture to become universally literate. Like, we know that in the 7th century B.C., the Israelites were using cylinder seals for all of their commerce that had alphabet letters on them, as opposed to cylinder seals in the surrounding cultures that were using icons. So we have to assume from that, it's a safe assumption, that the Israelites were substantially alphabet literate by the 7th century. Now, in the Roman Empire, some people criticize, they say, well, universal literacy is a fairly recent thing, but when they excavated Pompeii, which was buried under volcanic ash in 79 AD, what we find is that the city that was sort of preserved in time, that all over the walls are written very literate graffiti by the society's underclass. So you have to assume that if the society's underclass is writing graffiti on the walls,
they know how to read and write.
They must know how to read and write. So it's safe to assume that in Pompeii in 79 AD, that the substantial portion of the population was literate. I mean, and then when you get to the Dark Ages, this phenomenon occurs where, one of the historians estimates that for 400 years, not a single king, not a single nobleman, not a single artisan could read and write in all of Europe, in Northern Europe, during the Dark Ages, that the church had such a monopoly on the written word, the only books that existed, existed in monasteries. So the literacy rates was less than 1%. And then Sir Thomas More estimated in his lifetime that approximately 30% of English people could read and write, English men, he said. And then, of course, de Tocqueville came to the United States in the 19th century when he wrote his history, and he marveled at the fact that he could not find a North American who was illiterate. So we went from literacy rates that were almost 0% in the Dark Ages to literacy rates that were almost 100% in the 19th century, and we can attribute this dramatic rise, especially in the developed nations, predominantly to the invention of the printing press. And Life magazine just had an issue on the newsstands that shows it's a commemorative issue that the 100 most important technological innovations of the last 10,000 years, and they list the printing press as the number one innovation. I would list the alphabet as the number one innovation, but I recognize, and they recognize, that the printing press really changed society. Now, Alfred North Whitehead once said that the major advances in civilizations all but wreck the societies in which they occur. And certainly there can be no greater example of what happened than what happened in the Renaissance and immediately thereafter, because the whole society was thrown into such discombobulation due to the religious wars and the strife between Protestants and Catholics and the Protestant sects breaking into numerous sects that began killing each other, and then on top of that, the witch hunts. And you have a society that is plagued by some sort of a upheaval, almost a mass epileptic fit, if you will, and it's very difficult to explain. And I propose that McLuhan was right, that the medium is the message. How you perceive information is almost as important as the content of the information you perceive. And reading and writing requires only one part of your visual field, the cones of your eyes, your right hand, and primarily your left hemisphere.
Explain the cones.
Side of both men and women.
Explain the cones of the eyes, because that ties into this as well.
Well,
the cones
every,
and the rods.
Every human person has two different visual fields that in each retina of the eye, the cones and the rods. And the rods are seeing dim light. They see the big picture. They see the parts of the whole. They see patterns. And
the
occupy about 99% of your retina. The cones of your eyes, on the other hand, see with incredible clarity, and they have focusing power. And they are predominantly used in tracking so that you see one thing, and then you see another thing, and then you see another thing.
Leonard, thank you. You have outlined in detail this deep dive into history of this unknown, hidden, forgotten, but key and important piece of the puzzle as to how and why the goddess of mythology and women in real life and society lost their co-equal and rightful place, and what it's going to take to gain it back and put us back into balance. So, an important and a fascinating read, The Alphabet and the Goddess. That was Leonard Schlain. And I'm Laura Lee. Thanks for listening.
Laura Lee Online. www.lauralee.com